So yesterday we talked about we talked about the Hohenberg-Cohn theorem that says that basically if you know a density of some system with a fixed type of interactions, so we're thinking of some class of Hamiltonians where the control knob is some external V, and this is this electronic structure problem. So we've pinned down the nuclei in some iteration of this Born-Oppenheimer approximation. I mean, they can move, but at some classical level. But for each position that we set them at, we want to solve what all the electrons are doing around those nuclei. So they all get, you know, combined together in some complicated potential that can nonetheless be determined. And then we want to solve this, you know, interacting problem of electrons that has some ground state wave function psi and then some ground state density n. And again, don't get confused. If I write a hat, this is, you know, psi dagger r sigma psi r. So this is this operator, but it's just nice to call it n hat because that's what it measures, right? It's the density. And what we found is that the Hohenberg-Cohn theorem says that for a given ground state density of some interacting system, or really any system that has a fixed type of interactions, including none, that there's only one external potential V that it could have come from if it exists. So it's got to be unique. So kind of at most one, I guess is another way of saying it. And then we ran this arrow twice, and we argued that there's an interacting arrow and there's a non-interacting arrow. And this non-interacting arrow defines this unique, if it exists, Cohn-Sham potential. Right? So then that gives us this thing called the Cohn-Sham system, which you can see is a non-interacting system. There's just no VEE term in these operators. And then it's convenient, or it's sort of insightful to define this piece called VHXC. And we're going to break, that's a lot of today is we're going to kind of chop that thing up into some pieces and kind of explain what these letters HXC mean. I'm not going to go, you know, way into it, but we're going to sort of at least break off this H part mainly. And then and a lot of this is just to help you guys make contact with a lot of the literature that's out there to understand the approximations that are being developed or have been developed and why they're successful. So when you do this, what you've done is you've defined, this is just a definition of VHXC. So I haven't really done anything here. It's just trying to suggestively write this Hamiltonian in as close as a form to the original one. So basically to bring back the original external potential that defined the problem we were interested in. And in doing so, we pay this price, which is this extra VHXC bit, which just connects back to this VS. But the VS is just defined. I mean, it's only got sort of one job, right? And its job is just to make the solution have this density. That's all it is at some level. And so then what we're going to talk about today is sort of energy components. So sort of break up the energy into pieces and break up. We'll see if we can break up the potential into more pieces as well. So kind of back on this is sort of this Cohn-Sham side of things. Back on this Hohenberg-Cohn theorem side of things, we saw that there's this energy functional, right, which we kind of talked about constructively how you would make this thing. So you do this double minimization where you propose a density, and then, well, you can think of this thing, first of all, as sort of reporting the ground state energy for any density. So you can propose a density, and then you can try to minimize the T plus VEE part over all wave functions that have this density. And then, of course, the potential energy just comes as a matter of course because it's an explicit density function. So we argued that it has these two pieces, this f of n, and then this external potential energy part, right? So this is just the same n, just goes here. But this is some complicated functional that may not really have any conceptual form that you can really imagine writing, though we'll sort of write a form for it today if we get through everything. But so this is universal in the sense that if I think about fixing the external v, that just goes here. It doesn't go here, right? So there's no dependence on V here. But somehow F does know about V in a funny way because since it's defined through a minimization process, you can show, and we just argued that the functional derivative of F, well, let's see. So if we imagine that there's some ground state of our problem for a particular V, and we plug in the ground state density, we discover what the ground state density is. For that V, we get the ground state energy by definition. And then if we take the functional derivative of F and then set n equal to this ground state density, then we get back V, which is the potential that goes with that density, the one that would give rise to that density. Okay, and that's just another, this looks kind of surprising, but it's just a restatement of the fact that F is defined to sort of minimize part of the energy, right? So it's just this kind of stationarity condition that derivative of E with respect to N at this point gives you zero, right? Okay, any questions about this stuff so far? All right. So that's just some background stuff. And then we can similarly write a energy functional for the Cohn-Sham system.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It seems that V here corresponds to the density, okay? So you previously established that there is correspondence between density and V. And but you didn't explain yet how do we construct V for a given density?
Yeah, I didn't. Right. So I didn't. How do you? I don't think you think about constructing. Let's see. Okay. Right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. You can do what you're saying. So you're saying, given a density. So you're saying, how do we follow this arrow? I guess is what you're saying. How do we actually constructively follow this arrow? So how do we, if you just propose to me any kind of wacky density, just anything out of the blue, how do we get this V for it?
Yeah.
Right. So the answer may disappoint you, but I mean, I can tell you sort of one way, and it's literally just guess and check. I mean, and this is something that I've done for some research projects. So literally, each of these arrows has sort of a disappointing answer, which is that all you do is you basically start with some kind of V1, some trial V, right? And then you simply you plug it into, I'll just think of this as some functional of this V. So this Hamiltonian operator is a functional of this V in some really trivial sense, right? Meaning just put that V there and then solve for the ground state, right? And I won't write the ground state, but let's say we solve for the ground state density M1, right? So we solve for the ground state wave function, compute its density, right? And then we just compare, so we have some target N that we're trying to get. We're trying to figure out which V gives this target N. So we get this trial N, we see that it's different. It's not the same, because we just made up V1 somehow, right? So then we just, maybe it was flat or something. We get this trial N, we simply just compare it to the N we want to get, and we do things like we say, okay, if this trial N is larger than the target N somewhere, right? So let's draw a picture. So let's say the target N looks like this. If our trial N is larger in some places and smaller in others, then let's say our trial potential kind of looked like this, then we want to bring this thing down. So that means we want to push the potential up there, right? And here we want to bring in more density in the middle, so we'll lower it here. So we just make a small update. We just sort of, you know, compute this difference between our target density and our trial density. And then we just take the difference and maybe damp it by some small number, add that in, add the negative of that in here. And then we just get a new, you know, V2 and so on, and try that. And this is incredibly expensive because we're talking about problems where we can't even really solve this problem once. And so now I'm telling you, let's solve it like 10 times or something. Because this can converge rather fast in practice. You can do maybe like 10 iterations and get pretty fast iterations. Maybe I can show you guys a movie of this tomorrow for some 1D interacting systems. So we actually have an ongoing project with this DFT group at Irvine, me and some of my collaborators, where we're actually carrying this out for a lot of interacting 1D systems, sort of non-trivial continuum interacting 1D systems. And you can actually do this, but it's, you know, very expensive and sort of infeasible for any real serious problem of interest and so on. So this part is a bit disappointing because, you know, you're just sort of doing a guess and check algorithm, which is sort of an old as the hills, not very intellectually interesting. The intellectually interesting part is that at some point this will converge. So at some point you'll get some V infinity of R, and it will give the density N of R that you set out to get up to some very tiny errors that, you know, basically you can ignore. And then the intellectually interesting part is that the Hohenberg-Cohn theorem tells you that this V must be like the V that you've now discovered, the only V. There's only one. That's the power of the Hohenberg-Cohn theorem, right? So the point is that you found some V that works, and then this theorem tells you that's the only one, you know. And that's why I keep saying it's unique if it exists. So in practice, this if it exists part has sort of dogged a lot of more rigorously minded people, and that's fine to think about. But I mean, from my point of view, when you're going to sort of do studies of specific problems, you can just do this, and then if you find it, you know it exists, right? And then the only real question is it unique? But that's the more interesting side of the Hohenberg-Kohn theorem, is it says definitely it's unique, right? And now, you know, again, this comes with some caveats. You might ask sort of, it's unique, you know, but how sort of sensitive is it to errors? And that's a different question, right? So there may be that there's certain classes of densities where you know, tiny differences in N make a very huge difference in V, and it's sort of hard numerically to pin it down. Okay.
We can't find the density exactly.
Sorry?
I mean, if we take trial V, then density is found only approximately.
That's fine, yeah. That's right. And that's sort of what I mean. So that's right. So you only ever find these things approximately. And there's some classes of systems where you might rightly worry that these like tiny errors that you leave here in this N infinity, that the tiny errors that you can never sort of ever totally get rid of, that those tiny errors could sort of lead to huge errors into V, right? So there's some kind of, it's like some kind of dividing by zero problem, right? Or dividing by a small number problem, where sort of it's like an ill-conditioned map. You know, trying to invert this thing is sort of ill-conditioned in some sense. And so that can happen, right? I mean, there's no reason why that can't happen. It's just that in practice, we've done this for some classes of systems. We found that, you know, there's a broad range of systems where this works okay. I mean, you just, right. But are you worried that somehow there's another V sort of sneaking around that sort of?
I'm worried that, I mean, if we, for example, are looking for N using variational approach, it is not very exact.
Right. So yeah, there's the exact side, the theoretical theorem side of things, and then there's just the in practice side. And I can tell you only a little bit about this in practice side because it's rather new. So people have, you know, many years ago, just sort of for pedagogical reasons and for some sort of research reasons, have done things like take atoms and solve them exactly, or mean more or less exactly, using quantum chemistry codes that can sort of include all the realistic orbitals. I mean, even like spin orbit effects, everything you want. And they get some density, and they do this. You know, they've done this more often on the non-interacting side. So this can be very readily done on the non-interacting side. So, you know, all you have to do is go through the same set of arrows, but each time this arrow is just solving a non-interacting problem. And if you just do that, what you've constructed is the Kohn-Sham potential for that density. You know, same argument is just on the non-interacting side of things, basically following this arrow instead. And so people have done that quite a lot, and it works fine for like atoms and things. But anyway, maybe there's nothing I can tell you that's going to totally convince you. I mean, a lot of this is sort of yet to be tested more and more. So maybe we need to test more classes of systems and see if there's some where this seriously breaks down, but we haven't really found any that are so bad.
Did you say that dfdn equals negative v is only for the non-interacting?
No, well, this is the interacting case. Really, this is sort of a general statement about any class of interactions. Right, okay. So any sort of reasonable class of interactions. Though here I'm kind of intending this to mean our interacting case, because that was the next thing I wanted to write, was to say that we can, you know, we can talk about energy components for we can talk about energy components on both the kind of interacting and non-interacting side. So what I wanted to get to was basically define a few different quantities that people talk about when they build approximations in DFT. So kind of continuing on this interacting side, we can we can say that the energy, now once we plug in a particular ground state density that goes with a certain V, let's just call that, you know, let's just call it E. Let's call it E0. And then the idea is that is some T plus some VE. Now I'm not writing any hats on here, plus V. So this is just some kind of typical notation that you'll see in a lot of DFT literature. And the idea is that this is the, you know, the exact kinetic energy, the exact total interaction energy, and the external potential energy. So any questions about what those are, right? So it's just taking the ground state wave function and putting them around each of these terms, right? Okay, so shouldn't be any mystery there. And then similarly, we can do this for the Kohn-Sham system. So if we put the same density in and, you know, we've constructed this Kohn-Sham potential, we can say that that energy has this kinetic energy part called Ts, okay? It's just the definition of, you know, if you just take the Slater determinant, I mean, typically it's just one Slater determinant. It could be more, but it's typically one. And the one that's defined just to have the same density as the ground state density of your interacting system. and you just compute its kinetic energy, right? Same operator now, but you get a different answer, right? Because it's a different wave function. Over here, you solve this thing and you get some Slater determinant phi, right? But again, it's defined to have the same density. That's sort of its job, right? That's all, in the end, at the very beginning of this thing, that's all its job is just have the same density. So its job is not to have the same kinetic energy. So in general, this just will be different, right? This is kind of one of the magical things about this kind of cone and sham approach, and especially as they moved from this kind of cone sham construction toward LDA, is that basically by luck or by some deep physical insight, these turn out to be rather close in practice, okay? But not the same, but rather close. What else is there? So of course there's the external potential part. There's no interactions, right, by definition. And then just as we break up the external potential itself into the original V, right, that part has to be the same because it's the same density integrated against the same potential. So there's the same V, right, those are equal. And then there's just this other piece called EHXC. I'm not calling it VHXC because, I could, but it's just clearer to call it EHXC, even though it looks, it's like another V-type term, but let's just call it EHXC, right? So, you know, structurally, you get it by integrating some potential against some density, but it's also a little clearer to call it EHXC because not only does it account for missing interactions, it also accounts for the difference in kinetic energies. That's important. So, you know, back in the first lecture, I had mentioned to those who know a little bit about some of these terms and things that in quantum chemistry, people talk about the correlation energy as being differences between Hartree-Fock and between the Hartree-Fock energy and the exact energy. So here we're going to sort of start seeing other differences. So just basically we're trying to pay attention to what things are going to go into the C, because we can define the H and the X. Those can just sort of be defined by some convention. And the C is just collecting all the differences, like the fact that TS differs from T, right? And the fact that we don't have any interaction term, this kind of thing. So those are all sort of being collected in this term, right? And then, let's see. So let me use another board now. So I wanted to put all this off as long as I could, because this is the stuff where I think it gets confusing, because you just start, there's like this proliferation of terms and names and things, and often these are just immediately thrown at you the very minute you open a book on DFT. So I was trying to put these off as long as possible, because these always get me confused. There's just too many. But let's just keep defining more things. So there's this thing EH, and this is the Hartree energy. We actually already defined this in the context of Hartree-Fock. Here we're just defining it, okay, as just some density functional. It's the reason partly that you define it and that you break it off from the rest of the energy is just because you can. It's an explicit density functional. So kind of any piece of the energy that we sort of know or imagine is there in some approximation that we can write explicitly in terms of the density, let's do that, right? Because what we want to do is sort of whittle this thing down until the only thing that's left is something that's very hard to figure out how it relates to the density. That's sort of the philosophy. You know, also, again, we know from experience with Hartree-Fock that this is some very big piece of the energy. It's this integral r prime VE r minus r prime n of r prime, right? So this is this kind of classical electrostatic energy. And we can just compute that if you take the functional derivative of this thing with respect to n, that we get basically, we still have one integral left. I'm used to writing it for the Coulomb. Let's write it for our general case. Okay. So what is this thing? This, if you look at this carefully, you see that there's still some dependence on R here. Okay. So we took the derivative with respect to R, n of R, and so we get something that you can just define to be this thing called the Hartree potential. Right. So what is this? This is, so when people talk about Hartree-Fock being a kind of mean field theory, this is like the mean field, one part of the mean field that the electrons in a Hartree-Fock calculation feel, like one of the two big parts, right? So the idea is that this is where you take the density of all of the other electrons, actually including the one electron that you're talking about, so there's sort of a double counting that happens here, or not, maybe double counting is the wrong word, but sort of a self-interaction effect that happens here. That's why you also need this exchange piece in the end. You take that and you convolve it with the interaction potential, I guess you could call it, and then you get some kind of additional external effective potential that is due to the presence of all the other electrons, including the one that's sort of feeling this potential, right? Okay, so I got a little bit out of order, but let's define a few more things. So let's define, sorry, like I said, it's just going to be a little bit messy, just a proliferation of definitions and things. So let's define EHXC to be F minus TS, okay? So in some sense, this is going to capture, let's think about what goes in here, right? So F was, if you recall, is this min over all wave functions that give a specific density n. Of the expectation value of t plus vee, right? And then this is the kinetic energy of the Cohn-Sham system, right? So when we subtract these things, what we're trying to capture is both sort of like all the missing interaction energy, right? That's clearly part of F, right? Because you can think about, you know, by linearity, you could put the psi around both the T and the VEE if you like. So we're trying to capture all of the interaction energy that's in here, right? And whatever little bit of kinetic energy the Cohn-Sham system didn't catch, right? So that's both, that's in here, okay? So this is just a definition. Sorry, I made this a little bit of confusing because I talked about what the H part is, but now we're sort of putting it back in. Okay, sorry, right? Because, you know, this is some big piece of the interactions, but here, this thing contains sort of all the missing interactions. So that's this kind of H and X and part of C, okay?
So we can calculate T of S, but we can't calculate X, so we can't actually calculate C.
That's right. Yeah, very good observation. So we can calculate TS, okay? We can calculate EH because it's just a definition that we're sort of making up, right? So we calculate it because we just want to, and we can just put it in. Right? So what we're trying to do is, again, whittle down stuff until we really kind of land on the sort of the core part that we cannot calculate. That's what we're really after. And so that core part is you know, this little missing piece of T, okay? And like sort of all of the, or not all, but some kind of, you know, the sort of very non-classical part of the interactions, all right? So if we want, we can further break this thing up. And again, this is just, this is again a definition of what's on the right-hand side. We can say that this is EH plus EXC, okay? So this is a definition of that, all right? And again, the X may bother you. The fact that there's two letters, you may say, well, what's X, okay? So we can define that, but this is now for sort of more historical and practical reasons. It's most of the time these are left together, okay? And we'll talk about why. But if you want, we can define it just for different completeness.
Same definition as you have EHXC.
Yeah, it's consistent with that definition. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Because so F doesn't include V. F is just T plus VE, right? So if you subtract those from each other, the V's cancel. That's just the external potential part, and then you get a difference in the T's and a difference in the fact that VEE just isn't there, and that's all consistent with what I wrote. Okay, so I'm kind of, you know, redefining things a few different ways. So it was already implicitly defined there. Here I'm defining it a little more explicitly and talking about what goes into it.
Just because I'm confused, because F here contains VEE, okay, in the particle interaction.
But that's right.
On the top of the board you have EHXC entering expression for E.
Oh, okay, did I? Let's see. That may just be wrong. I'm sorry. That good catch. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I'm just going to erase this part. I think I just was making that. I was just doing that on the fly, and I think I just was misleading. Yeah, that's right. That's right, because I defined this to be this Cohn-Sham part energy, which this isn't how you really compute the energy in a DFT calculation. You always compute the energy from this guy, right? So you're always trying to build approximations to this density functional, and then put some energy, some density that you obtain somehow that we're going to talk about in a minute, back into this thing. Okay, right. Good catch. So we're gonna break that. We're gonna bring back EHXC in a second and talk about how that fits in. All right. So just for completeness, if you're anything like me, you want to see everything kind of defined. So let's just mention what is the definition of EX. Okay. So EX of n, you can just define it as that you take the Slater determinant that comes from the Cohn-Sham system. So we make this Cohn-Sham system defined to have the same density as the interacting one. And we take that Slater determinant, which was obtained without any explicit reference to the interaction operator, but we just now take it and wrap it around this interaction operator, and then subtract off the Hartree energy. Remember, this thing is defined to give this density n, right? So it's just a definition. But in practice, this thing is thought about, but sort of not really computed in practical like LDA DFT calculations. But I just, we can define it. And then if you want, you can finally, break this thing up totally into pieces. So this in the end defines EC, okay? But again, like I keep saying, these are typically not broken up in practical calculations. Any questions about that? Okay, so now thanks for pointing out the error with EHXC, because now we'll put EHXC sort of in its proper place, all right? So now we get to this expression that you see in many textbooks, and often it sort of uses the starting point. And you can see why I didn't really want to talk about it until the last minute that I absolutely had to, because all this stuff is just sort of complicated, just too many definitions. But as we argued, that the energy is this F plus V, okay? I mean, earlier I didn't write the dependence on N, but it's always there, right? And then we argued that from this definition of EHXC, that F is TS plus EHXC, right? And then, of course, we can break that up a little bit more if we want to. And in practice, that is how it is done. So just anything we can compute explicitly, kind of why not, Okay, so this is like a very important, set of definitions to understand how people really do real, like say LDA or other approximate Cohn-Sham DFT calculations, right? So the point is that we know this. Let's say we can obtain a Cohn-Sham system. We'll talk about, again, kind of how you obtain a Cohn-Sham system very soon. Let's say we have a density, and we obtain a Cohn-Sham system that gives that density. We can calculate this, because all we do is we look at our Cohn-Sham system and we just read off its kinetic energy. That just comes out as a matter of course from solving this Cohn-Sham system, right? We can get this, because we have the density, either some trial density that we proposed, or we solve the Cohn-Sham system and its density is defined to be the same as the interacting one, in the exact setup at least. So we get this. This, again, also is an explicit density functional. So this guy is the thing, we're after. This is the thing that gets approximated. Okay. And then just a couple words about why we leave this X and C together. It's basically just sort of empirical. I mean, there's people who thought about why this is, but empirically, it turns out that if you try to approximate this quantity as a whole, it just works better than if you try to only approximate the C part, basically. So when you do these approximations and you try to obtain EXC from these approximations, you make an error both in EX and EC. And it just, in practice, it turns out that you make an error of one sign in EX and an error of the other sign in EC, and then they tend to cancel to some degree. And so in practice, it just works better to approximate them together. So that's just the only reason why. Otherwise, we could also try to write EX in terms of quantities that we can calculate, and we would do so. It just doesn't work as well. Okay, and then finally, one last very important thing, okay? So we already defined EHXC. So you know, we showed that if you do DF, you do this functional derivative of this F, and then you plug in your ground state density, you get the potential it came from, okay? Similarly, the thing that plays the role of F for the Cohen-Sham system is just TS, right? There's no VEE, so it's just TS. So if you do the same thing there, by this exact same argument, you have to get the Cohen-Sham potential, okay? So with those two in hand, with those two facts in hand, it tells us that if we take a functional derivative of EHXC, okay, that EHXC is just the difference in these two guys, right? Okay, and then this, well, we could say this defines VHXC, but we've actually already defined it. So really what we've done is we've sort of come full circle and gotten it another way, or sort of shown that it's related to EHXC in a certain way. So if you remember, I was defining VHXC kind of pedagogically. I was saying, let's define this thing as the difference between VS and the original V to sort of motivate what the Cohen-Sham system is sort of doing, or sort of, it's sort of nice to look at the Cohen-Sham system. See, there it is up there, as sort of the original system with the interactions ripped out, okay, but then replaced by some kind of mean field, which is like this VHXC of a type, right? Yeah, it's a funny thing, right? Because you know these other guys, right? You take the derivatives and you sort of get a negative V, and these are like energies. Here you take a derivative of an energy and you get a positive V. So it is a little, it does look a little bit asymmetrical, but that's how it is. It's just a funny definition. That's just how it is. But yeah, good point, because that is an important thing to point out. So this is not an error. It really is positive VHXC. Right? And you see, again, that is our we sort of had just defined it out of the blue. But then we also made this definition of EHXC, and now we see that they're sort of tied together. Okay? And this is very important for approximations, right? Because, and again, you know, we can further, remember we said that derivative of EH here is this thing defined to be VH. So we can break off that VH if we want. And then that defines this little thing called VXC, okay? Right? It defines it through VH, right? So we just defined VH already, okay? And we already identified that EH is some part of EHXC. And so that tells us that, you know, derivative of EXC is this thing called VXC, right? So yeah, lots and lots of definitions, right? Lots of stuff. Okay. So these are the kind of energy components. And the important thing is that these potentials come from them. And this is really what's going to make everything work, right? Because if we can get, this is just kind of in a nutshell. I'll say this again more slowly and show you some pictures or sort of some drawings of how this is done. But what people do finally in practice, at least for the LDA, is you approximate this numerically. So you actually do large-scale quantum Monte Carlo calculations of these uniform interacting gases of electrons. And you obtain this for every different density of that uniform gas. I'll say this all more carefully. And then they literally fit it to some function, right? Because if you take derivatives of sort of different points, you might get very bad results. But what you do is you do a very high-quality fit of this data, and then you literally take its derivative to get this part of VHXC, right? So it's literally do. So you data fit, take a derivative. And then that gives you a way of, for different densities, obtaining what additional VHXC you should add to your original V to define your Cohen-Sham system, to get a density, to finally plug into the density functional and get energies and things. Okay, so we'll go through that a little more carefully and slowly. But you have to tie all this together to be able to do that. So you have to know these relationships between these energy components and their derivatives. Okay, so I just said it in words. Let's just define it now a little more carefully, right? So so just so we have a particular approximation in mind, let's just introduce the local density approximation. Okay, the LDA. Right? So this is kind of like always sort of the starting point for Cohn-Cham density functional approximations, and it's nice because it's unique. Okay, so when they get into these fancier ones, like these ones called GGAs and hybrids and other things, there's sort of a whole zoo of these things, right? There's even, I've seen this like cloud in some papers where they do different font sizes to show like how many people use this one or that one, kind of like what's your favorite approximation? But there's sort of only one LDA, and even though there are these more fancy approximations, there are still many cases where the LDA actually works better than the fancy approximation. So it just depends on the context. So the fancy ones can work better, say, for like small molecules, but LDA can still work surprisingly well for like extended condensed matter systems, sort of large systems. And so the LDA is just, let's just define it, it's just this. So you just say, we've identified this little piece, sorry, not little, but this sort of piece that we cannot really break up anymore, or we don't want to break up anymore. You could try to peel off the X, but in practice, it's just not a good idea.
Question.
Yes?
Do you mean a small number of molecules or literally small molecules?
I meant that a molecule is small compared to a condensed matter system. So I meant like a small molecule. I mean something that sort of has some strong finite size effects. Yeah, good question, right? So the LDA, as we'll see, is sort of something that you would not expect to work in a situation where the density varies very rapidly. Now, and actually in practice, it sort of does for sort of reasons that are not fully understood. But that finally kind of comes home to roost, I think, when you work on very small atoms and things. And I think there are these other fancier approximations that work better for like a single atom or for small molecules and things like that. So good question. So you just define it as follows. You just define it as the EXC of a uniform gas, an interacting uniform gas, where instead of it being a functional of the density, right? Where the member of functional can do anything, right? It can look at pieces of the density far away, correlate them. It can do an integral over the whole density. It can, you know, anything you want, right? It's just a totally arbitrary map or something, right? You replace it by an integral over a function of the density, right? So I'm putting kind of parentheses here instead of brackets to emphasize this, right? So this EXC, right? What is it? This EXC UNIF thing, right? So this is, again, not a functional, right? It doesn't know that there's an R here. It only sees N, right? So this thing is just a function of some number, right? N, okay? And let's try to carefully, you know, peel off everything, right? So I'm kind of looking at this definition of all these things, connecting it back to E, right? So it's E, and then what do we subtract, right? So we get rid of TS, get rid of H. These are all functions of this uniform gas calculation. Okay? That's what this thing is, right? So what do people do? I mean, how does this actually computed? So literally, someone just proposes, I mean, you could even call this thing mu, UNIF times times N, right? Okay, that's what this thing is. So what do people do? They literally just set up a uniform gas calculation, propose some. Well, I'm just thinking that for uniform gas, the potential is going to be flat. So I'm trying to emphasize that instead of having some integral over some V of R times your N, it's just going to be a chemical potential, which is just sort of a name of a flat potential, if you will. Okay, so I'm just sort of mentioning this sort of pedagogically here, so it's just a parenthetical. That what you do is you really just choose some mu. Let's say you maybe don't even know what density it's going to give, and you work in some kind of, you know, grand canonical ensemble setup, and then you run a powerful quantum Monte Carlo code that can deal with interactions in these uniform gases, and then you just see what density you get, and then you just see what energy you get, right? Then you just set up a non-interacting calculation, and you just kind of tune its chemical potential until you get the same density, and it's just this uniform system, right? So these are just, there's this one uniform system with interactions underneath, right? This is supposed to be like the density. And then there's some non-interacting system with the same density. You just tune them to have the same density, right? Then you just, you know, compute what is the kinetic energy, right? I mean, this is all kind of done, you know, per particle in practice, but I'm kind of writing them as totals. You just compute what is the kinetic energy of this non-interacting gas tuned to have the same density, right? You just compute its Hartree energy as well, and you compute its potential, and then you just figure out what is its XC energy per particle. This isn't a per particle the way I wrote it, but that's what people do in practice. You just compute its XC energy, again, just defined by subtracting off all these other things that you know and can compute. So it's just that little hard kernel at the end of this thing that you can't compute, the thing that the numerics is giving you, right?
Right up. Mm-hmm. You're telling me that I have to do all this calculation by quantum Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
And then I go away and then I just do DFT. Why don't I use quantum Monte Carlo to start
it? Yeah, so the question is, why don't we just use quantum Monte Carlo to solve problems? Because the uniform gas is just more tractable than your kind of average electronic structure
problem.
You're
doing this all for like just uniform gas.
All for uniform gas. So somebody, in fact, the somebody's were, is this paper from, I think, 1982 by Sepperly and Alder. And I don't know if I wrote the reference in my notes, but I can give you guys the reference. And they just did this back in the 80s, early 80s, one time, basically. And then people have been doing different fits to it ever since. And I'm sure the calculation has been checked and updated since then. But, you know, for many years, people are using this Sepperly and Alder data. And so literally, you just do this once. And just get this curve. So basically, you just get some set of data. I should have gone and looked at what it looks like. So EC, I can show you a picture of what that looks like. So so if you make a plot of the correlation energy per particle, EC, as a function of n. Remember, n is not a density here. It's like it's not a density function. It's just a number, right? It's just this flat density of this uniform gas. Then typically, it's negative. EC is always negative, and it's small, and it just kind of looks like roughly like this for different systems. So these are some small numbers, like kind of, you know, well, it depends. I'm not going to try to write any numbers because it depends on your system, but basically they're, you know, much, much smaller than one, these numbers. It's just tiny corrections, but they're absolutely crucial for getting interacting physics correct. EX is larger, but again, as I said, you approximate these together because in practice you make some errors in both. The error is coming from this approximation, right? So this is an exactly calculated thing, more or less, up to some very tiny numerical errors. The error is treating this really non-local, if you will, functional as an integral over a local function, right? But the errors you make in this approximation, the ones that are associated with EX and the ones that are associated with EC, typically cancel for the most part. So it just turns out, people have just tried both, and it turns out putting them together just works better in practice, right? So then you get some function EX, and then you just take its derivative. So you just take a derivative E XC dN, and you get UNIF. And you get a V XC of N, right? So this is the guy. I mean, this is the thing you really need to do practical calculations, OK? So then you approximate. You say that I'm going to approximate V XC, the actual functional, something that should be this horrible non-local thing, right? As just an integral over this local function n of r, right? So again, you fool it. This thing is a function. It's expecting a number. But what you do is you feed it in a bunch of different numbers at different points in space. And from it, you cobble together an actual varying. So this thing is really like a chemical potential, right? This thing is telling you how much should you shift some overall potential energy to dial in the density you want. But this thing is actually a function, right? So in the end, you get some approximation for some function vxc of r, because you sort of ask what chemical potential would the uniform gas need to have this density here, 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 and so on. Sorry, it's not an integral. You just plug it in, right? Like this, okay?
Right, but then you're not getting it the atom anymore.
Sorry, say that again?
Like if I just plug this in a single point of R, then that's not just a functional thing, it's like dependent on R as well. Right?
Yeah, you want it to be dependent on R. So N varies. So in the uniform gas, N is flat. And so Vxc is a number. Vxc is a chemical, is some kind of, it's like the exchange correlation chemical potential. It's like the extra amount of.
Right. But why do I want to write that as a function over N? It doesn't sound like right. Which R have I chosen
here? Any R. It's sort of fixed yet arbitrary. So,
right.
So I'm actually about to draw a picture of this, right? So let's draw a picture. So let's.
But it's not arbitrary. It depends upon, it's not the same. If my N fluctuates, then Vxc is going to change.
Let's draw a picture, and then maybe this will help. And then we can debate it a little more. So, because, I mean, I want to have this debate. So this is good. So I want you guys to think about, this is sort of shocking that this works at all, right? It's sort of only work for like really slowly varying densities that basically are like flat for huge regions of space. But then the kind of brash approximation here is that we're just going to do this for like any density and see if it works. And let's draw a picture of what we were going to do, what we're actually going to do. So what are we proposing here, right? So what we're proposing here is that, well, first of all, let's try to envision what this, just very cartoonishly, let's envision. Maybe tomorrow I'll go and get some real plots of this thing, but I just wanted to, conceptually, schematically, let's just say that VHXC, UNIF, of N, it sort of must look like this, right? So it must look like, I'm not sure of the exact curvature part, but this, just the downward sloping part sort of has to look like this, right? And let's think about why, right? So if we want N to be small, then we want to raise the chemical potential, right? We want to make there to be a cost for particles to be in that region. We want to drive out particles. That's consistent with N being small, right? And then if we want N to be large, we should lower the potential, right, and sort of invite more particles in. That's all. So it has to go down, right? Very, very schematically, right? So there's probably some wiggles in it and some other details, and I'm not trying to propose this is exactly how it looks. Maybe I'll go get a picture of it for you guys for tomorrow. But let's just, you know, use this thinking very schematically. So what do we do when we do one of these? And we'll actually talk about this whole loop, and we'll kind of stitch this together into an entire algorithm in a second. And I was hoping to get through all this today, so this is good. But let's just think about one step here, right? So the idea is that we've talked about that in principle, we can say we have an interacting system with some density, and we can just define a non-interacting system to have the same density. The interesting thing is that the Hohenberg-Cohen theorem tells us that when we do that, whatever potential defines that non-interacting system, there's only one at most. Okay, but in practice, there always is. So there's just one. But you know, how do we cut this knot, right? Like, how do we ever find that potential if we can't see the exact density? Right? The only way we could see the exact density would be to solve this horrible interacting problem, which we can't afford to do, or we can't really pull off. Right? So we can't cut this knot. This is sort of how you cut the knot. Right? So what you do is you propose some sort of guess or something for the, somehow you propose an interacting density. You say, maybe this is my interacting density. Right? Then you use the LDA. And so how do you use the LDA? Well, you say, we have this curve, and we want to sort of locally have this curve everywhere in mind. Right? And this curve, what is it? It's this VHXCN curve. I'm putting the VH part back in. I mean, but the core part that you approximate is the XC. The VH is just defined explicitly, as I've written it, as an explicit density function, density functional. And so what do? You just see, OK, I have this density here. That's a large density, right? So that goes somewhere here on this curve. So that means I need a small VHXC, right? Fine, so I put a small VHXC here, okay? This is VHXC I'm trying to draw. This is the thing that you add to your potential, the one that defines your problem that you never change, the one that you're trying to solve for. This is gonna be the thing you add to it to get the Cohen-Sham potential, right? Then I go here, this is a low density, so I go here on the curve, right? And I get a large VHXC correction, right? And again, here it's, let's say I pick some rather, you know, moderate but sort of high point. And I get, you know, a rather low value for VHXC again, right? And I just do this locally. So I'm trying to imagine dragging this little circle along here, right? And I build this thing, right? And so I can just do this for any density, right? So I can just propose some, you know, some sort of made up, not made up, but sort of, you know, trial density. I can say, maybe this is my density. Well, let's see, right? Let's just see. And so if this were a uniform gas, and my trial density was, I'm saying, maybe the flat density is has some value, then this can report back to me how much I need to adjust the chemical potential of some non-interacting system to give me that same density. So in kind of one shot, exactly, I can find the Cohen-Sham system for any flat potential in this LDA approximation. So it's exact, right? This thing would be exact if N of R was just N, right? If it was just flat. Do you see why, right? So again, it's just because that's how it's defined, right? It's just defined by saying, if I, my trial potential was flat, and I, you know, I basically visited this curve, and you know, I would, of course, get a flat VHXC. It's telling me how much I need to correct my original V by to get a Cohen-Sham system with a flat yet different mu or potential that's going to have the same density as the interacting one. Whatever interacting one gave me, this flat one that I proposed as a trial, right? So it's exact for that. So any questions about that exact limit, right? That's important. So then all I'm saying is that maybe if the physics is nice to me and I can zoom in and treat a region of my density as flat, you know, you can always zoom in enough and get things to look flat if they're smooth, then this patch is really the exact value that with interactions, if everything is kind to me, would really give this value. It's just that, of course, you know, it's not really flat. It's always sort of changing a little bit, right? So if you make this thing flatter and flatter and flatter over longer and longer distances, this really is an exact approximation because someone did some hard work on this numerics and got this adjustment mu that you need. Okay, but then we just boldly apply it to more and more rapidly varying densities.
Can you look at this? How we find the VHXC?
Yes, sure. So I've kind of thrown a lot of definitions at you, so I'm very happy to tell you. So basically, we argued that. Somebody can go and do, they can go and do two calculations, right? They can do a calculation of, they can just propose an external potential and get some density in an interacting system. And this is the hard work is done, right? And then they can get its energy. They can read off the total energy per particle of this interacting gas. Then they can just go cobble together a non-interacting gas, you know, and get its energy per particle and break it up into all these components. And then they can just do this for every different uniform gas density that they can come up with, right? Just over a full range of all different values of a uniform gas density. And they can subtract off all these little pieces and get this one piece, EXC of N. And then you can appeal to these definitions and these various theorems and consequences of them to say that if I just take a derivative of this EXC, so I fit this to some specific function, right? So I take this EXC and it's some curve that I just put down a bunch of points numerically by just doing these interacting calculations over and over again and plotting energies and taking differences. And then I know that its derivative has to give me this VXC. Then I take this fit. The reason you fit it is so you can compute a derivative, right? And I compute this derivative analytically, right, with the fitting parameters chosen ahead of time. So I just have some funny function, some rational function or something with some logs and things. And I just literally take the derivative analytically on paper and with the fitting parameters left in there. And I, you know, put them in, and I just get a curve for this VXC, okay? And I'll try to get you guys a picture of this thing. But you know, it kind of has to look like, when you put the Hartree back in, it has to look like this, more or less. And that's it, right? But now I have I boldly use this value everywhere in space. So do you want to ask part of your question again? I mean, I'm trying to give some insight in this. So this thing, again, is just defined as being the amount you need, if you add the H part back in, it's defined as being the amount you need to correct the chemical potential of a non-interacting gas to get it to equal the density of some interacting gas, right? So you're saying this interacting gas had a certain density N at a certain value mu that I chose. Mu is sort of the flat V, right, the external V. And then I turn off interactions, which is going to make the density change. But I can counteract that by raising or lowering the chemical potential. And that's what this is. Someone computed this. How much do you need to raise or lower it to keep the density from changing as I turn off interactions, right? So there's some magic shift in the chemical potential that'll keep the density from changing as I rip out the interactions. Then I just know this value numerically. I just explore what this value is numerically for uniform gases. Then I just cobble this. This is just a bunch of chemical potentials, right? It's just a bunch of chemical potential shifts that if the system was really just a bunch of uniform gases, like if this was just one uniform gas that wasn't talking to this uniform gas, right? If they just didn't know about each other, this part of the system, somehow the physics was blind to the physics over here. And it just says, I'm a uniform gas of this density. this is how much I need to add to the original potential to keep the density fixed as I rip the interactions out. That's the idea, right? So I can use this in practice by saying, maybe this is the density of my interacting system. Fine. What non-interacting system would give me that density? And I can get this curve, VHXC, which I can finally add to V of R. I can take this curve. I'm kind of drawing it in 1D. Of course, it's 3D.
So we can get, we know E of H, but that's just, you can write down
that. Yeah, it's just a part that you pull off in practice. So I'm trying to be honest with you here. I could have left them all together and maybe been less confusing by never pulling EH off. But I felt like that would also confuse you because you would wonder, why are there these three letters that we always write? What do they mean? So I wanted to be honest with you and tell you that each of these three letters can be defined. And in practice, people always leave the H part off. They always leave the XC part together, at least in these kind of standard approximations. Maybe there's other ones where you want to address EX. But so it makes everything a little bit confusing.
How do you get T of S?
Yeah, T of S you get by, we'll talk about that sort of, this is the next thing I should say. So T of S, you get it by literally taking your Slater determinant that you get from your Cohen-Sham system and wrapping it around the kinetic energy operator. So what I'm doing is I'm kind of leading up to this Cohen-Sham algorithm that, but I'm doing it in pieces, little kind of bits and pieces. So let's think about it right now. So for a made up density, right, you can, some trial density, it's not made up, but we're thinking that somehow it should be close to our physical density. We can say, we can figure out what, this answers the question for us of what Cohen-Sham system, what non-interacting system supports this density, okay? We can use this LDA approximation to attempt to answer that, right? And then what we'll get, though, is we'll get, it won't totally work perfectly, because the LDA is only true for flat densities, right? It's only true for uniform systems. But we'll get some VHXC from the LDA. We'll add it to our V of R. That'll give us the V of S, right? So we'll get our, we have our V. We add to it our VHXC from LDA, okay? That gives us an LDA VS. And then we can take that LDA VS, put it into a non-interacting Hamiltonian and solve it. And that'll give us a, right, so we'll put it into this non-interacting Hamiltonian, solve it and get a Slater determinant ground state. And then we can compute things like TS as the expectation value of that Slater determinant around the kinetic energy operator, say. You can do those kind of things. So we can get these energy components. And the most crucial thing to realize is that if we did this once and we wanted to now know what energy do we have, we don't get the energy from the Cohen-Sham system. This is one of the key things to realize, right? The Cohen-Sham system's job, it only has one job, right? Like, you know that meme, like you only had one job, right? So it only has one job. And its one job essentially is to give us, okay, maybe two. It has two jobs. Its job is to give us the density and maybe TS, okay? So you get TS, which is a big part of the kinetic energy. But to get the energy, to finally know what energy have you gotten at the end of a DFT calculation, you take the density from the Cohen-Sham system. That's how you get it. You take TS from the Cohen-Sham system, and then everything else you get from these functionals. EH is an explicit density functional, so you just compute it. V is an explicit density functional. It's just an integral of V and N. You compute it. This you have approximated, right? We wrote it up there. In the LDA, it's just you do this integral over the uniform gas energies, probably per unit length, and then you plug in the density at each point, and you get an energy. So you always get it back from the functional, okay? You don't get the energy by just saying, what's the energy of the Cohen-Sham system? Only pieces of the energy, right? So if you guys will permit me like 5 minutes, I wanted to, because this is going to be important for the tutorial today, I want to go through what is the Cohen-Sham algorithm.
And so when you talk, sorry. When
yeah,
you
no problem.
T of S there, that's like T of S for the fixed n that we've tested. Is that
Yeah, you can define the T of S for an n through the Cohen-Sham system by coming up with one that gives that n. That's right. Is that what you're asking? So.
Well, I mean, we fixed out n.
Mm-hmm.
So we fixed out trial density.
Yep.
we've run up through this procedure, going through this kind of Shannon system, find this phi, and then we've taken the expectation value to kind of going to do with that phi.
Right.
Give us this TS, and that's in that TS for this end. We've never done any kind of minimization.
That's right. So we haven't attempted to find the best in. We just have an in that we proposed. So that's the last thing I wanted to take 5 minutes and try to explain, because this is something you guys are going to carry out in the tutorial. So hopefully also by doing this in the tutorial, it'll sink in a little more. So this is the people call this the Cohen-Sham equations. I kind of prefer the name the Cohen-Sham algorithm, whichever one you like. Okay. I think calling the equations does it a disservice, because it's really a very ingenious algorithm. So, and there's a very talented former grad student at UC Irvine, Lucas Wagner, who proved that these a very interesting result, that this Cohen-Sham algorithm always converges. It's a very kind of cool result. And it has to do with the convexity of the energy surfaces. But also, somehow, this algorithm gives you always an arrow in density space. It always tells you where a lower energy density could lie. It's very neat. So we could talk about that at some point if you want. So the idea here is that you don't ever want to touch an interacting wave function, right? Phis are OK. That's the Cohen-Sham part. But no interacting wave functions, because that's too expensive. We never want to see one. We never want to touch one or have to deal with one. That's what you're trying to avoid. So you're trying to put all this machinery together to somehow only work with densities and maybe non-interacting wave functions. These are already kind of expensive. These are just impossibly expensive, right, for real 3D electronic structure problems. So here's the algorithm, and then we'll wrap for today. So so given a one-body potential, let's say Cohen-Sham potential. Vs of I of R. So this is for a non-interacting system, right? Then you just compute the ground state. Okay. You compute phi, and it's made up of orbitals. Be a little more explicit, because this is often how it's written out in textbooks. So these orbitals satisfy, they each satisfy this kind of single particle Schrodinger equation, non-interacting. Okay, you got these single particle energies. These are important to think about, because these single particle energies, this is how you get these band structures that you see pictures of. So I'll show you some pictures tomorrow. Okay. So people make these pictures of these band structures of these Cohen-Sham systems. I mean, they only show them when once it's converged. This is in some trial step, right? I should put little I's on all this. So this is all at step I, right? So we're trying to go through some iterative, we're trying to iteratively find the ground state density. And when we're done, we plug it into the energy functional to get the energy. Okay, compute the density. A big surprise. Okay, it's a non-interacting system, so the density is just the sum of all the individual orbital densities. Okay, there's sort of a not often mentioned in textbook step called, I can call it step 2.5, and that's that you take n of I, you kind of work with something n of I tilde that's like lambda n of I, and then 1 minus lambda n of I minus 1. So this is just an important thing to mention, that you have to control the convergence. Kind of a technical detail. But you have to do some kind of thing, maybe not exactly this, but you maybe mix it with the previous density to control the convergence. So you just try to take small steps. Otherwise, you can get into limit cycles or other things. You can kind of overshoot. Very, very kind of technical detail. But this technical detail is needed for this proof that these always converge. That's just a kind of a comment. And finally, this is the important part, most important part. This is just a way of saying solve the cone-sham system. So you obtain a new cone-sham potential as follows. So it's just Vs I plus 1. This is what's really important, right? So you always put the original external V here, and then you compute this VHXC, which if you want, you can write it as VH plus VXC. And in practice, you use an approximation. So we're thinking of LDA, because that's the one I've told you about. There's others. All right. Well, yeah, so let's write it out. It'll be helpful. So VH, it's actually a function, not a functional so much. All right, so the idea is you get this other, so you basically say, you plug in your density at step I, you get this correction to the original potential. It's saying, we've ripped out interactions, so what do we have to add back to the potential to correct for that? That's what this thing is computing, and this is what you'll do in the tutorial. So we've actually cooked up a black box VHXC for you in the tutorial that you're gonna be feeding little densities into on just a two-site system. And it's gonna tell you how to correct the potential of the original interacting system to account for the missing interactions, right? And for changes in the kinetic energy, this kind of thing. And then you get a new VS, and then you just go back, okay? And you solve again. So we can talk tomorrow about why this actually gives you, you may think, I'm just gonna get the same density back, right? Like, isn't this a stationary point? But in practice, you don't, and we can talk about why, okay? Because in a nutshell, it's because this VHXC is defined to be the thing that corrects for the difference in the density, the non-interacting density that would give n of I, and the interacting, sorry, not densities, or the non-interacting potential that would give n of I, and the interacting potential that would give n of I. This interacting potential does not give n of I. We haven't found the right n of I for it yet. So we're adding in sort of the slightly wrong correction to the right v. Well, so we'll get a different vs. If you solve this vs, you won't get back n I. You'll get some new ni plus 1. We can talk, it's not so obvious from the way I've written it. We can talk a little tomorrow about why does this thing actually go forward? Why do you actually get a new density on the next step? And why don't you just sort of go in a circle, right? But what's interesting is that you actually do get a new density on the next step, and then it very rapidly converges in practice, especially for sort of weakly correlated systems. And then you converge to some density, and in practice it's very close to the interacting one if you actually have solved the problem using some fully interacting solver that can deal with a non-uniform system. And then you take to compute the energy, so the kind of step infinity when you're done is that you just take whatever your n infinity is and you plug it into your approximate functional. Right? And you get your approximate ground state energy. Right? So again, importantly, I'll write it differently. It's not equal to the sum of these cone-sham energies, right? It's not the case. So it's not just that you add those up, okay? Those just give you, part of those just gives you TS, right? So it gives you part of this, but you don't take the energy of the cone-sham system and treat it as real energy at all, okay? You just use it to get TS, and then the other stuff you get from LDA, and you do get a rather accurate energy, and this is very useful in practice. So there's tons and tons of practical uses for energies of these realistic systems, right? When the Hamiltonian is realistic and the energy is realistic, then you can deduce all kinds of interesting things about your system, like molecular motion and phonons and equilibrium bond lengths of molecules, all kinds of things from energy, plus having the density is handy as well. Okay, so questions about this algorithm? So you see that this algorithm succeeds in the goal it sets out to, right, which is no wave functions, no interacting wave functions. All we touch are densities, right? We touch orbitals of non-interacting wave functions. And that's already a bit expensive, but it's a worthwhile price to pay. We use them just as sort of tent poles to get another density. Then we feed it into some black box. Remember, this thing, all it does is it takes this density and it just looks at it locally in space, and it cobbles together a new correction, this VXC, that we add back to our external V that we're trying to solve for. we get a different VS than the one we set out with, and then we just solve it again and go around and around and around. Okay, so we never touch a wave function, like a complicated correlated wave function.
Do you understand correctly that the LDA is necessary to get the first trial on sham potential?
So you guys are free to go, by the way, if some of you need to go. I'm not trying to keep you now anymore. But I'll stick around for questions. So so what was the question one more time?
Did I understand correctly that LDA is used to get the first trial on sham potential?
I was just saying that as I was really illustrating here, I was really illustrating this step. So the first one can be, you can kind of start from anywhere you want, really. So you maybe one reasonable starting point would be you just take your external potential, the one that defines your problem that's never changes. I mean, never changes within this problem you're trying to solve. You take that and maybe just plug it into the non-interacting Hamiltonian and you get some wrong density or something. You know, but at least it'll have the right number of particles and sort of have roughly the right shape or something. So you just do the non-interacting approximation, maybe like a Hartree-Fock calculation or something. So that already accounts for some very rough approximation. You see what I mean? Kind of any density that's reasonable enough can kick off this process. Is that what you were asking? You just start with any density. And then at first, it'll be very, very wrong. So this correction will be rather large. Well, it'll always be pretty large. But I mean, it'll make it not large, but it'll make a big difference in the next density. I mean, large in that sense, far from convergence.
LDA used as a way to convert from n from the density to the potential to be.
That's right. So exactly, it's a way of flipping. It's a way of following that arrow, that I arrow way up top there, where I said you have some density, and then there exists some, it's more the ni arrow. So there's some VS that supports that density, right? It's like a way of finding that. Okay. Sorry. You need to follow both arrows. That's really the key. We'll talk more about that subtlety tomorrow. So it's easy to follow the non-interacting arrow. You could just solve a few different, you can do a guess and check on non-interacting systems until you find a non-interacting system that'll support that density. You can always do that. The hard part is this I arrow that gives you the external V that goes with your trial density, right? This is what I'm saying in words, and tomorrow I might show you a little more clearly. Is that why can you get a new density out? It may seem at first like a contradiction, like I thought this thing was supposed to give me back the same density I put in. But no, because this thing, this VHXC, is defined as you follow both of those arrows for this trial density, and you get a VI and a VSI, and you take their difference. And that's what this VHXC is. So that gives you a new Cohn-Sham potential that gives you a new density. We'll go into that in more detail, okay?
All right, I'm thinking, I mean, mm-hmm. This kind of, so. I want to think about this in terms of like what happens to this potential. And the way I can kind of see that is by saying, okay, the idea is I take whatever I want with the electrons, and I assume that kind of each electron is, each electron just kind of sees the potential generated by every other electron plus the background potential from the ions.
Mm-hmm.
Then they all correct for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see this background potential again, and they all correct for that again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of what's going on here?
Right. It does have. You're kind of talking about a mean field.
That's the thing. That's the picture I have going in my head. But then the next question I'm going to ask is then that's just mean field.
It's not just mean field theory.
So
I would say.
What's wrong with that picture?
Well, so one way in which it's not mean field theory is that a very simple case where it's not mean field theory is that if I only look at flat systems where my external mu defining the problem, you know, is flat always, then. The Cohn-Sham systems I'll get will also be flat mu's. You know, they'll also have flat densities. And LDA will be totally exact, 100%. I mean, up to tiny, tiny numerical fitting errors. It will be totally exact for those systems. So it hasn't a totally exact limit, which is interesting. So, and the thing is, mean field theory would not be exact. So straightforward Hartree-Fock mean field theory would not at all be exact for that interacting uniform gas system. So that's one limit where I can clearly say that for sure LDA. I mean, so first of all, the whole formalism is absolutely exact, but then within LDA, this is still some exact limit.
I get like it's different. I'm trying to see, like, in that case, the picture I have where I'm saying, you know, like, I'm sort of the way I'm describing this in my head is I'm saying I'm generating kind of an effective non-interacting system by modeling the electron interactions as if, like, this electron seeing every single other electron that's generating the potential.
It absolutely has a mean field form. Like, mathematically, it has the structure of a mean field theory.
Right, but what's different?
But philosophically, it doesn't. Yeah.
What's philosophically different about
the? Yeah, the difference on one superficial level is that mean field theories, you're choosing the mean field to be self-consistent with the, with like in the case of Hartree-Fock, sort of self-consistent with the wave function. So you're sort of saying the mean field is the other orbitals in some sense.
Okay.
I mean, in the Hartree term, it's the density of the other electrons. In the Fock term, or the kind of exchange term, it's this kind of, you know, the other parts of the single particle correlation function that account for the avoidance of the electrons. So there's a self-consistency on the level of orbitals. Here, the Cohen-Chehm system is defined just to have the same density. So it's a different sort of self-consistency. And you don't get the energy from, this is another key difference, you don't get the energy from the Cohen-Chehm Hamiltonian. That's another key difference, right? So in Hartree-Fock, you get the energy by wrapping the wrong wave function around the right Hamiltonian. Here, you take the right-ish density from the Cohen-Chehm system. It's sort of can be rather close to the interacting density. And you get the energy by plugging it into some black box thing that you fit from some quantum Monte Carlo. Right? So you get the energy from a very different way. So instead of taking the wrong wave function and putting around the right Hamiltonian, you take a pretty good density and put it into a pretty good approximation to the energy functional. So you're taking two reasonable things and putting them together, so you get a very accurate energy. Whereas the other case, you're taking a really bad wave function and putting around a really good Hamiltonian, and that's not so smart. I mean, it doesn't work that well. So in practice, LDA beats the pants off of Hartree-Fock in many cases.
Is there a way I can think about this physically in terms of how we're generating this pretty good wave function?
Mm-hmm. Like, so one way to think about it is you're not generating a pretty good wave function. The Cohen-Chehm wave function is overall pretty bad.
Okay.
It's a bad approximation for the real wave function,
except
in one key way, which is its kinetic energy is pretty good. But its interaction energy is pretty bad.
Okay.
So that you don't use it for the interaction. You use it for just the TS part. This is some of the genius of Cohen and collaborators. Is that they recognize, they did a lot of thinking about which parts of weakly correlated systems. I'm saying weakly correlated because I'm kind of defining them as systems for which LDA works. So it's a little bit circular. But which parts of these weakly correlated systems, which parts of their energy do we have a pretty good handle on, right? And one part is that we understand in some qualitative level or some quantitative level that their kinetic energies are pretty close to those of like a Hartree-Fock approximation wave function. But the XC part is sort of missed badly by Hartree-Fock in some sense. You know, badly being the difference between how well Hartree-Fock does compared to how well LDA does. And so they said, let's kind of find this hardcore part, this kernel that we don't know and we can't really get our hands on, do something smarter with it. But another point I wanted to make about why this can work is that think about, again, in the flat potential limit, it's totally exact, right?
So if I just fixed mean field theory,
mm-hmm.
and I get complete crap from my energy,
mm-hmm.
but then I also would get away.
Oh yeah, this is a good point.
Function into a density.
That's right.
Take it to the LDA.
That's right. You can do this. So he's asking, what if you did a Hartree-Fock calculation, but your goal wasn't to get the energy from Hartree-Fock, but you wanted to get just use it to get a density? People
right.
do this. Yeah. So this is another thing you can do. And people do this. There's a nice paper about these things called density-driven versus energy-driven errors. Energy-driven means the error we're making in this thing, this function, there's this approx. So that's an energy-driven error, the fact that this is the wrong energy functional. There's also a density-driven error, which is the idea that we run this loop and we get some density, but it's not the density, it's just close to the density. You can try to get densities from other sources. You can try to get them from other flavors of calculations. So if tomorrow you had a better method to get densities that somehow got bad energies, and we do. Hartree-Fock can often get quite good densities. You can just plug it in.
But how does Hartree-Fock getting the density differ from this situation?
It's just you can kind of think of it as two different ways of getting the density. In the end, you're not obligated to use the Cohen-Chehm equations to do DFT. You can do DFT by just doing Hartree-Fock calculations and throwing them into the energy functional. So then it's still DFT because you're still working with energy density functionals. This is just something that people do. The difference is that there might be some technical cost differences. So it may be that I believe this is still a much cheaper calculation than doing a Hartree-Fock calculation on an interacting system. So there may be some minor computational cost differences for large systems. And then in practice, this is where I'm not enough of a practitioner to know that there may be cases where taking the LDA density, the LDA Cohen-Chehm equations density. May still work better than taking the Hartree-Fock in other cases. So you can try both.
The way you describe this, like I've done a bit of mean field calculation
uh-huh.
before. This looks insane. Like this looks really.
It's
really
very. Insane. This is why people get tripped up a lot on DFT
so
because it looks so much like mean field that people will say it's mean field. I would say it's absolutely not mean field.
Right, okay, but let's say like the means you're going about to get, like the self-consistent approach to getting this density, it seems exactly like what we would do in some kind of hypothetical.
Yeah, it's like mean field in that it's self-consistent. It's like mean field in that you work with Slater determinants and non-interacting Hamiltonians.
Yeah.
But what you, the key difference is what you do with your results, right? So what do you do in mean field? Again, you take the, you take your mean field wave function and you slap it around the original Hamiltonian and you say, I'm done, and that's my energy. And you treat your wave function as some proxy for the real system. Here, you're only, maybe I should emphasize this more, there's only two outcomes you're supposed to ask for here, the density and the energy, period. Okay, like on the most conservative level, you're supposed to only say, I got energy, I got a density, and you're supposed to totally not look at these orbitals. You're supposed to just close your eyes and kind of go la 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 and calculate them, and then put them into this thing, and then be like, okay, good, I got a density, and then throw them away immediately. Like that's like the most conservative way of thinking about this. Now, of course, people, as I've kind of alluded to, they open up the box, right? They look at these energies, and they look at these wave functions, and they say, maybe these tell us other things about our interacting system. And in practice, they do. But at that point, you're making a rather uncontrolled, even more sort of uncontrolled approximation beyond the LDA, you know? The LDA has some exact limit, which is flat densities. This thing of looking at orbitals and energies, we know less about when that is exact. You know, we have a few cases where we know that that's justified, and we have many other cases where we don't know whether that's justified, really. So it's just some kind of under the rug details in some sense. But we'll kind of open that box tomorrow and talk about it a little bit. So these are good questions. So, you know, the fact, if you're confused, I mean, it means you're kind of really taking this in and processing it, because it's sort of deep and complicated. So I want you guys to sort of chew on it. All right, I'm going to sign off on the mic here.